Hello, Diddly Dum. This is Peter Capaldi. I play the Doctor. Diddly Dum, 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 Diddly Dum.
Happy day, faithful listeners, and welcome to episode 87 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
I'm Mark.
And I'm Alan.
And we've had some news since last we gathered in the world of Doctor Who. For some time, we've been hanging on a rumour, an unconfirmed rumour, that Bradley Walsh would be the new companion of the Doctor. New companion of the new Doctor, even. Now it's been announced that, now not only has that been confirmed, but another two companions have been announced. Former Hollyoaks stars, Mandip Gill and Tosin Cole. Now, not being familiar with Hollyoaks, I contacted by text message one of my old school friends, who still admits to patronising the show. What was Mandip Gill like as an actress? She was okay, TBH. Got killed off a while back, though, LOL. What about Tosin Cole? He was not great with a numeral 8, TBH. I'm almost ashamed to admit, after this next message, I'm almost ashamed to admit I went to school with this man. Him and her were both killed off. Ha ha.
So, is he still at school?
You should think so, wouldn't you? You looking for dead characters, PMSL. I'll piss myself laughing. They're the two new characters of the Doctor. I got you, we're going to say that. Ha ha. She's good. Oh no. Alan? You sitting down?
Yeah.
She's good. Very Mank, LOL.
Mank with a C or a K?
With a C.
Ugh.
Well, that's interesting feedback there from the target audience, by the sounds of it. So.
That's interesting feedback from the illiterates who went to your school, though.
To be fair, it sounds like they went to my school.
I did even go to the trouble of searching through YouTube to hear him, the man himself, pronounced his own name so that we wouldn't mispronounce Tosin. Although I was listening to the most, I think, episode 99 of the Prog to Who podcast this week, a podcast featuring an interview with our very own Hayden about his new book, where either Mark or Bob, one of the others, said, well, I sometimes watch Hollyoaks with my daughter and I don't remember Tosin Cole. And then there was a delicious dramatic pause and the other one said, and you would, wouldn't you, really? Are any of us familiar with them?
Not
other than Bradley Walsh, of course.
Not at all. Although, do you remember, guys, when I said to you about me possibly going on the chase, that we were told that...
You were told that it may be the last series because Bradley Walsh might have another string to his bow.
Yes, I was, yes. And that was back in... Ooh, was it May, I think?
And Tipping Point.
And Tipping... Well, yeah, so that means Ben Shepherd's probably going to pop up at some point in the series, but
can we assume you've had no feedback
with regards to the chase
appearing on either of them?
Well, I was told that we may get picked for the chase, but it was likely to be the last series. And Tipping Point, to be honest, I felt thoroughly degraded when I was going for the interview. So you know, if I had to stand there and say, hello, my name's Maureen, I'm 49 from Essex and I love my dog Pippa and she's everything I mean to me, and then if I'm put in with that lot and I don't get the part, then I'm definitely doing something wrong.
Hayden, am I right in thinking that round about next spring you hit 3 years of service on the Diddly Dum podcast?
February, isn't it? Yeah, February.
So really you're quite used to being degraded, aren't you?
I thought television might mean my escape, but no, back in the cesspit.
I love the idea you actually got all the way to auditioning for Tipping Point before thinking, this appears to be beneath me. Watch an episode.
Interestingly, he said ironically, I picked up the news about the new companions on the Radio Times online presence. Now, you may remember when Pearl Mackie was announced, I was moaning at the time on the podcast about how the BBC's press releases for these sound completely unconvincing.
Oh, can
the quotes as, "I am absolutely delighted to have joined this wonderful team, very talented." No, that's been either written by a computer or by a PR rep. Interestingly, I've got a number of those quotes from this Radio Times article, and I want you to guess, which actually is slightly depressing culturally, but the answer to it is in a way slightly promising. Let's read a few of these and tell me if you can detect the one, the only one that actually sounds as if it was spoken by a real person. Chris Chibnall said, "The new Doctor is going to need new friends. We're thrilled to welcome Mandit, Tosin and Bradley to the Doctor Who family. They're three of Britain's brightest talents, and we can't wait to see them dive into brand new adventures with Jodie's Doctor alongside them." I'm not sure if anyone in conversation ever actually begins a sentence with "alongside them, comma," do they? "Alongside them, oh, we're delighted that Sharon D. Clarke is also joining the show." Jodie Whittaker said, "I am so excited to share this huge adventure with Mandit, Tosin and Bradley. It's a dream team." Mandit Gill said, "I am over the moon to be joining the Doctor Who family." That's twice family has been mentioned. "This is an iconic show with an amazing fan base, and I look forward to everything that brings. Certain roles seem unattainable, and this is one of those. So much so, I didn't believe it to be true." I didn't believe it to be true. I don't think people say that in conversations. "For the first few weeks, to be working alongside the likes of Jodie, Bradley and my old friend Tosin is thrilling. This show is worlds away from the work I've done previously, and that's the part that excites me most." Tosin Cole said, "I'm grateful and excited to be a part of this journey with the team. I'm looking forward to jumping in this Doctor Who universe." Matt Strevens, executive producer at BBC Studios, said he was thrilled to welcome Bradley, Mandip and Tosin to the new Who family. While Piers Wenger, controller of BBC Drama, added, "The casting of Mandip, Tosin and Bradley is a mark of the new creative ambition Chris is bringing to Doctor Who. He's already made history with the casting of Jodie. These three new characters complete a new and utterly unmissable team aboard the TARDIS." And then Bradley Walsh says, "I remember watching William Hartnell as the first Doctor Who. Black and white made it very scary for a youngster like myself. I was petrified. But even though I'd watched most of it from behind the sofa through my fingers, I became a fan. I then queued up for ages to get into the Carlton Picture House in Watford to watch the great Peter Cushing appear as the Doctor in a full-length feature film made in glorious colour. Am I thrilled to be part of this whole groundbreaking new dawn for the Doctor? Oh yes!" Whoa. Exclamation mark.
Hang on a minute. So how old is Bradley Walsh?
Christ. If it says that he's younger than me, I'll kill him.
I believe there was an article I read earlier on.
He's 56.
That said he's the oldest companion on record.
Yeah.
So Bernard Cribbins is doing cartwheels then, isn't he?
The article also claimed that second youngest after him was Nardole at 40.
Yes, that's the bit I read as well.
Wow.
I'm not going to tease, but I assume that you will agree that the only one of those that sounds like he actually came out of his mouth is Bradley Walsh's. Mm. Which I think actually promises well for him.
Hmm. I don't know. I mean, who would put two question marks after Doctor?
Probably someone who wasn't working in the BBC press office.
Hmm. Potentially. And also, I want to know whether Bradley Walsh has ever been to the Carlton Picture House in Watford.
I don't think you would just make him a random.
"I went to the Cineworld in 1965 to see Doctor Who and the Daleks." No. Well, all I have to say about this press release is that I am absolutely thrilled that this new team are coming on board. With this family together, we really are going to see a whole host of new adventures in the ongoing story that is Doctor Who, said Hayden Gribble.
I haven't even had my hair gelled.
Things, we don't know if they're companions, do we? Actually, we don't know quite what's... And there's a fourth person as well who's going to be a returning character.
They could be the equivalents of, I suppose, Mickey and Jackie, couldn't they?
Yeah, exactly. Mm. We don't know yet, do we?
But that works, doesn't it, though, don't you think? I mean, you saw the UNIT family back in the 70s, and, you know, I suppose you had the Tylers.
Anything interesting be happening in our lives? Hayden, do your book sales continue apace?
Yes, actually. It's still number one in the Kindle charts for television and radio. Fluella Benjamin is sixth. Ah, get in there, play school.
You're seeing The Phantom Menace.
Mm. Yes.
Do you know the bit where...
If you dare compare Child Out of Time to The Phantom Menace...
Where Darth Maul is...
This is better.
...is triumphing over having killed, Liam Neeson, then just as he thinks, you know, he's triumphed, up out of nowhere springs Ewan McGregor, cuts him in half. There's a sort of mystified look on his face. His body splits into two and he falls away into nothingness.
Mm.
I think that's how Fluella Benjamin's been feeling the last couple of weeks. It's me. Never want to use a short analogy where a long one will do.
So in other words, Hayden is the Ben Kenobi of the television and radio literature now, world.
I will take that all day.
Every time Doc struck him down with a blue pencil, it only made him more powerful.
I became more powerful than you could possibly imagine.
You may have got rid of these mistakes, but they'll be back and in greater numbers.
Mark and Alan, you been up to anything interesting?
I went to see Thor Ragnarok today with Polly, my eldest. That was fun. I mean, it's more fun. It's got a lot of jokes in it. Almost too many jokes in a way. It almost feels a bit forced in places. The flippancy, the one-liners. But it's, you know, it's a Marvel film. And I'd say it's the best of the three Thor films that I've seen.
Okay.
Three, four, five, yeah?
Yeah. Because I found the first couple of Thor films a bit, a lot more enjoyable.
Are any of you au fait with Family Guy at all?
If you're au fait with coffee, you're okay with Genko.
Well, have you seen, there's an episode where they go to the cinema and he thinks the film's about to start. And it starts about 10 times, but every single time it's just another independent production company. So he's like, oh, so it's about ships, is it? And then a ship goes past and it's called Sailing Ships Productions. And it goes back to, you know, like a volcano erupting. It goes, oh, okay, this is an action film. And it's called a Volcanic Layer Productions afterwards.
Oh, I know what you mean.
I can't, you know, after seeing that, every time I see those sort of those independent bits coming up before films, it's just, rubbish. I haven't been to the cinema since Dunkirk, actually.
What, 1944?
That's a hell of a long time.
I have about 77 years worth of cinematic history to go back on.
Did anyone else catch Blade Runner at all?
No, because I haven't seen anything since Dunkirk in 1940, so I haven't seen the first.
Did you go and watch it, Blade, Alan?
No, we didn't in the end, I'm afraid.
Well, I saw that recently as well. I very much, very, very much enjoyed that. Visually stunning.
At the time of the three new companions being announced, it was confirmed that Series 11 will be 10 episodes of 50 minutes each.
Hmm.
What do we think of this? Didn't they originally hint that it would be 10 minutes of 60 minutes each?
Yes.
Which sort of kind of mollifies you from it not being 13 episodes of 45. Imagine having said all that from Peter Capaldi's final season, that could probably have lost three episodes for me. And
we all know
even been a better
you.
Season, so...
Yeah.
So, I'll have to see how things go.
Yeah, it's a worrying trend, though, isn't it? Because this is what happened back in the 80s, less and less episodes. And I think that's the one thing that worries long, you know, older Doctor Who fans who remember that period.
Yes, possibly.
Could it also be the fact that... I'm not accusing or anything, but... Could it also just be the fact that perhaps the production team just don't want to do as much work on the show anymore? That maybe they do think that there have been shows that have been a bit flabby, let's say, that they've had to put out because they've got this 12...
Well, not so much flabby as rushed, I think.
So maybe they want to... Yeah, okay, that's a better way of putting it. So maybe they want to take their time a bit more.
Well, I wondered if it's indicated that these rumours that he's going to do it like... Not just a season arc, but a season-long story in the sense of Broadchurch. Maybe, you know, 10 episodes of 50 minutes might be more to his liking for that sort of thing.
You know, I mean, the show has to change all the time. You know, it wouldn't be on at all if it didn't do that. So I'm fairly open-minded about any changes. We'll wait and see how it goes.
Yeah.
Alan, you've been up to anything?
Yes, I had a sort of mini book launch on Monday just gone.
Oh, tell all.
I did a course earlier in the year called Read Now, Write Now, which is sponsored by Arts Council England. And at the end of it, we all submitted short stories to a book, which is called Right Time, Right Place. And we had it launched in my local library on the Monday. There was free wine for people who weren't me and that sort of thing. I got up and read part of my story out. It was all terribly pleasant.
Lovely.
Cool.
Civilised way to waste an evening.
I was wondering why I couldn't get onto the ground floor of the Hooseum last week. All these bloody people wandering, these la-di-da Hooray Henrys wandering in and out of the Hooseum library with cocktails in their hands.
Yes, all these posh knobheads who insist on spelling great with actual vowels. That was us, yeah.
Any way that our faithful sisters can access this tour de force, Alan?
No, but I'll scan it in and give you a link in the show notes to the
Splendid.
Scan.
Splendid.
Lovely.
Have you been up to anything, Doc?
Have you been up to anything, Doc?
Well, funny you should ask, Hayden. No, not much. I have just finished reading this week a book that I've been aware of for most of my life, but I've always thought, oh, I don't know, no, I won't bother trying it. But it's turned out to be extraordinarily interesting. A complete page turn, which was Out of the Silent Planet by C.S. Lewis.
C.S. Lewis.
Are you familiar with these chaps?
I don't read anyone else but myself.
C. Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, S. Lewis.
C. Mere Christianity, S. Lewis. I think he'd prefer to be known as.
Wrote a sci-fi trilogy, which I think is called Out of the Silent Planet, Perelandra and That Hideous Strength. And it's quite extraordinarily good. There are about two-thirds of the way through, you do start getting hints of, shall we say, religious notions coming in. But nothing as in your face as Aslan getting crucified and then rising on the third day. I think it's well worth a try. There are a lot of similarities at the beginning of it to First Men in the Moon by Jules Verne. And there are parts of it which are not vaguely similar to Riverworld books by
Kevin Costner.
No, something Farmer. First one was Costner, like, To Your Scattered Bodies Go or something. Anyway, clearly none of you ever read sci-fi books, so it's well worth a read. I always thought, oh, I don't think I will, because what if it turns out to be just I'm too old to read another Narnia book? And the other thing that C.S. Lewis is known for is his religious literature. No, it's quite good. I also, you remember me mentioning that when The Boat Comes In finished on the Drama Channel, it was replaced by the series that used to, in Mark and my youth anyway, come immediately after Doctor Who on Saturday afternoons, which was
The Duchess of Duke Street.
I was watching that last the other week. And the Hall Porter's ex-wife turns up and starts stealing things in the hotel. She says that to be a right old slapper who eventually gets kicked out. I thought, oh, shit. Oh, do I have seen this actress before? So I had to make a point of watching the end credits. Maureen O'Brien.
Oh,
right.
Vicky.
And designer Ray Kuzik.
Hmm.
Although I understand that Terry Nation took all the credit for it. what's this? Oh, Mark, you've dropped your star for Mathematical Insouciance.
Oh, thanks.
Why insouciance?
Oh, he's good at maths, he's just not fussed about it.
Yeah. Watch this. Mark, what's the square root of 4?
About 1.99.
God, that's amazing.
Oh, it's very good.
Mark, anything else on your mind at the moment these days?
Well, I have been perusing Twitter recently, and I noticed there was a spate of Doctor Who luminaries, people who were connected to DWM, the Doctor Who magazine, who all started suddenly tweeting, "I am not the Watcher." which I thought was rather bizarre. And I looked through the comments. And are you aware of the Watcher in DWM? He does the last page.
Oh, is this Watcher with an A and Watcher with an O at the same time?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, 100 greatest somethings in Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Doctor Who in 100 objects or something like that.
Yes. Well, this on the latest issue, the object is a pufferfish. And the article's all about things which are hidden in plain sight. And right. In fact, yes, at the bottom of the article, it even says, if you look hard enough, there's always something hidden in plain sight. Now, it turns out that if you go through the article and you take the first letter of each sentence, it spells out Panini and BBC Worldwide are cut.
And somebody found something controversial in this, did they?
Seriously?
Yes. And also, news has broken today that the Watcher, who turns out it was Nicholas Pegg all along, who writes for Doctor Who magazine and also operates a Dalek for the TV show, I believe.
Used to.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, he's been sacked. And it even gets a mention in Private Eye this week.
What?
Yes, in fact, the whole thing...
Curiouser and curiouser.
Hmm.
Oh, yes, there's a whole column in tomorrow's Private Eye.
Yes, indeed.
Show me the link. Oh, right. As Doctor Who fans await regeneration of their hero. Oh, right.
I mean, the article goes on to say, was it also mentions at the end about Nicholas Pegg and his filthy acrostic.
Mrs.
It goes on to mention that BBC Worldwide were irked by the increasing independence of the title and its willingness to allow contributors to criticise Worldwide's hunger to cash in on the series. Which I find odd, because whenever I've read... whenever I've read DWM, it never seems particularly controversial.
We can't say we've noticed, can we?
No!
I must say, I've not been reading their reviews of Class, which seems to be one of the bugbears of... It's unclear, isn't it, whether it's BBC Worldwide or Panini. I suppose they're...
Well, it says Worldwide in instigating a full inquiry, apparently, because there's been anti-Brexit and Trump comments in some of the articles, which were made by interviewees. I don't see what that's got to do. It's alarming,
like,
really.
That's a bit like mentioning that you're against... You interview Russell T. Davis and he mentions he's against bullying. That's a bit like saying, oh, he's being political.
Mm.
It sounds to me like one of those things where they've chosen to regard it as political.
Yeah.
And they could easily have ignored it.
And it even goes on to say that editor Tom Spilsbury had a falling out with BBC Wales after daring to be critical of the little scene BBC Three spin-off Class. And in the summer, he took a payoff and left the magazine. So, you know, this is all...
That's interesting, isn't
it? Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was quite intrigued reading that because... it reminded me of the well-known outtake from The Daily Show in America back when Jon Stewart was still presenting it. He had Grantom publicising a film. I think it was We Are the Morgans or some similar piece of detritus.
Yeah.
And they showed a clip of the film. And as they were showing the clip, apparently Hugh Grant turned to Jon Stewart and said, why did you show that clip? That's an awful clip. And Jon Stewart came back to him and said, well, next time, make a better in movie. And it reminded me of that a bit. You know, if you can't... And Class in that regard is the same as Brexit. If you can't tolerate valid criticism of it, you can't tolerate any criticism at all, can you? So,
no.
Was this the movie where Hugh Grant played a bumbling yet charming Englishman?
No, it was the movie where Hugh Grant played a bumbling... formerly charming, but now everyone knows what he's really like, Englishman.
I seem to remember when Tom, with our first name terms, now he's got some virtue. I think I might have said something mildly satirical, which I suppose I ought to say it back, given that he's been, shall we say, disappeared for showing some independence. Although, as Mark says, it's not big. It's exactly stood out, is it? I wonder...
Lonely as a cloud.
I mean, I remember at the time when there was the supposed disagreement between Stephen Moffat, Piers Wenger, and Beth, what's her name? And then there was the even more extreme bust-up between Stephen Moffat and Caroline Skinner.
Mm.
There were pieces in Private Eye saying that he had blazing rows with them at some Comic Con event.
Did he scream, "You will be deleted" or something?
You'll be erased from Doctor Who, I think.
Yes. Yes, that was about the last time I saw Doctor Who get mentioned in Private Eye, as far as I can remember.
Yeah, and when you said that, people were saying, "Oh no, this is clearly a lot of nonsense. Private Eye don't know what they're talking about." In fact, I even remember Radio Free Scar at the time dismissing it on the grounds that isn't Private Eye, but just a bit like Punch.
Ha!
Which, at the first, I sort of scorned that. Then I thought, I'm quite impressed that they know what Punch is.
Yes. Yeah. I wonder how many times Punch got sued for libel. And was subsequently vindicated.
And so you don't know. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if this is, I see this is being talked about now, this Private Eye thing. If the same people who are saying, "What do Private Eye now?" No. And now saying, I say it must be true. And you don't know. It depends, doesn't it, who leaked this?
Yeah. I mean, this all seems terribly heavy-handed by BBC Worldwide, to be honest. It even mentions Worldwide instigate a full inquiry, as well as insisting that all staff and freelancers must undergo a training course.
Yeah. I mean, you don't know. If this was leaked to them by Tom Spilsbury and Nicholas Peck, then you don't know. I mean, it could be entirely true and they want to present their side of the story. Could be that they're preferring to, paint themselves as being in the right, although it seems strange, doesn't it?
Yeah, so all the DWM staff can be sent to the reminder room.
So from what Private Eye says, it sounds as if Tom Spilsbury got kicked out for being a little too independent. And Nicholas Pegg got kicked out just because they need to save money, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's I think that's probably the crux of Nicholas Pegg's annoyance. I'm not sure what. I saw some speculation that it had something to do with Shada. I think
Shada.
That's something to do with Shada. That
yes, where did I hear that?
But I think it's in the Mirror article, but it can't because
yes, that's right.
Because Nicholas Pegg produced the a Big Finish Shada, I believe, and they're trying to make out that he was upset it wasn't on the disc. But I can't believe that's. I mean, that's got nothing to do with Panini either. So why would Panini be mentioned in his acrostic?
Do we know this Marcus Hearn, who's the new DWM editor?
Oh yeah, he's been involved in Doctor Who fandom for many years, writing books and stuff, hasn't he?
I don't know.
But it's a very familiar name.
The company has also set about slashing the magazine's budget, which means that several long-running columns are being axed.
Yeah.
Several. Oh,
I saw Johnny Morris, who, not the guy from the zoo, the writer. I saw Johnny Morris saying that he is not writing any more fact of fiction for the magazine.
No!
Yeah, so I'm hoping that's not another one that's gone. I mean, Fact of Fiction's and The Watcher are pretty much my two favourite things in the whole magazine.
I save every Fact of Fiction to use as research and we review a particular story on. The thing is, I never get around to you looking at them.
No, they're really good, really fascinating articles.
One less reason to buy DWM.
Yeah.
Yes, as if we needed them.
So DWM is being revised to become more slavish and less interesting.
Surefire seller.
It makes you wonder if BBC Worldwide understand their target audience at all.
Mm.
You know, the idea of a fawning, slavish love of all things Doctor Who related is so far removed from the reality of Doctor Who fandom, it's in a different bloody time zone.
Yes, but I think with that, Alan, you're thinking that they're doing this because BBC Worldwide think if they criticise the show, then fewer people would buy the magazine. I suspect it's far more likely that they think they're criticising something that they are responsible for and they cannot tolerate it. Well, it's what happens in middle management, isn't it? You promote utterly talentless people, and the only way they can survive doing their job without any talent for it is to silence any criticism. Yes. Make sure that everyone is ruled by a culture of fear with a small f, where no one dares point out that that's a bloody silly idea. Fortunately, this never happens in the civil service.
Of course.
I bet that's it. Oh, that's interesting. Right, well, we'll provide in the show notes, gentle listeners, faithless listeners, links to the Private Eye article and, if we can get away with the copyright, possibly a scan of that DWM article by, what's that, feels like a farewell article by Nicholas Pegg. Something tells me that... Even if it is breaching DWM's copyright to put that article on something like Tumblr, the BBC aren't going to draw attention to it by suing us.
No, they've altered the digital copies already, apparently.
Really?
Oh, now that's interesting, isn't it? Oh, how clever of us to have bought a copy.
I don't know what the digital copies have had done to them, but unless they've just completely excised the page.
Said, Nicholas Pegg has resigned for being a bad man who could not cope with how lovely everyone at BBC Worldwide is. Marcus Hearn has been brought on board because he was previously the editor of Pravda magazine in the 1970s. Warning, this may be a lie.
Right, well, we are looking this week, faithless listeners, at the season 19 Fifth Doctor story from March 1982. Earthshock, written by Eric Saward, directed by Peter Grimway. Anyone want to start?
Shall I give it a go?
Go on. Don't want any tears.
Yeah, well, we've watched three stories from the 80s over the last few weeks, haven't we? And I think there's certain similarities between them. I think there's a certain level of darkness and violence that is noticeably greater than your average Doctor Who story.
In fact, I think
you could almost add Seeds of Doom to that list as well, couldn't you? All four stories have the Doctor involved in acts of violence. In Seeds of Doom, obviously the Doctor's twisting people's necks, waving gun around, punching people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Varos, we had the acid bath thing and the Doctor quipping. Remembrance of the Daleks, we've got Sylvester McCoy blowing a planet up. And here we've got Peter Davison repeatedly shooting the cyber leader in the chest with a gun. So I just found that interesting that we seem to have selected some of the darkest, most violent stories in Doctor Who.
In the canon.
I think where this story differs most, though, is probably in two places. I think the script and the amount of fun, deliberate or otherwise, that I had whilst watching them. Because I think all of the 80s stories we watched had a certain paciness and tightness to them. I think Earthshock lacks some of the scripting flourishes that I thought elevated Vengeance on Varos and Remembrance of the Daleks. It never had a sugar moment or any of the sort of stylistic touches of the Varos script. And I'm not sure the plot hangs together quite as well as either of those. And like I said, the other thing was it didn't feel as much fun watching it as it did those last three stories. Although, having said that, I have to say that the Cyber Leader is great value and certainly brought a lot of joy. Yeah, I watched it with my two friends again, and the Cyber Leader was a big hit with his catchphrase, which they soon picked up on.
In the same way that the pick and mix from Woolworths used to be great value, but you wouldn't take it on MasterChef, would you?
Well, no, quite. But having said that, we still enjoyed the story. The Cyber Leader was magnificent. Belle Reed was good value as well, we felt. That certainly brightened things up, especially having just watched Psychomania a couple of weeks before with one of my friends, which stars Belle Reed, an old British horror film.
Who? Psychomania or Belle Reed?
John Levine. Oh. John Levine crops up in that film. I think I mentioned it.
Oh, really?
Yes, just as a desk sergeant, and he's dead after about 10 seconds. Bless him.
What happened? Did he try to read his poetry to someone?
I managed to hide the video case from them so they didn't know that the Cybermen were going to appear. And I managed to get the DVD started before they noticed the Cybermen on the title menu page. So that was quite a delight when we got to the end of episode one and the Cybermen turn up and they're like, oh, brilliant, it's the Cybermen.
Oh, excellent.
I remember this story quite vividly from when it was first broadcast, because this is probably the peak of my Doctor Who viewing. The peak of my Doctor Who fandom, I would say, when I was younger. Probably from about season 17. I mean, I loved the show since the start of the Tom Baker era when I was growing up, or I certainly watched it a lot, but I can really remember vividly, like, sort of season 17 on to season 19 is sort of like my clearest memories, and I think my fandom was definitely at its peak as a kid then. And I remember being extremely excited about the return of the Cybermen and surprised. And their Cyberlead is great, isn't he? David Banks is just superb. I know there's criticism that the Cybermen show too much emotion in this, but actually I think that's almost a part of their arrogance. Yes, it is. I have the same feeling with the Cybermen in Revenge of the Cybermen as well. I love it when they've got personality. I like it when they're so arrogant that they think they've got rid of all their emotions, where they clearly haven't.
But isn't part of the scariness of the Cybermen the idea that, you know, we will make you like us? It's not so much, you're going to give us metal bodies, as you're going to take away all feeling and emotion. Having said, on the other side, I suppose, as I think someone said on one of the DVD extras, there's only so much dialogue you can write between the Doctor and a computer before you run out of things to say.
Well, exactly. That's why they had to bring in Davros, isn't it? For the so much for the Daleks.
I think you're right there. There was somebody reacting to the new companions on the Guardian website. You know, Below the Line, it's called.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier today, and there was some mention. Bradley Walsh mentioned hiding behind the sofa, as everyone always does. And this chap said, "Oh, the scariest thing about Doctor Who is that the ideologues are getting at our children." And I thought, well, hang on. The two most famous villains in Doctor Who are the space Nazis and the metal communists. So which side do you think these people are on exactly?
You were saying, Mark, you thought the story didn't hang together compared with the other 80s stuff we've been looking at.
Yeah, I can't quite. As with a lot of Cybermen stories, sometimes, I mean, I get that there's a big conference on Earth that they need to break up before these people form a galactic alliance to wipe out the Cybermen. So I can understand their motivation, but how do they get 1,500 Cybermen onto a freighter? What does the...
15,000.
How do they get 15,000 on there? I mean, what's the ship's manifest say? Who's paying for this? The Cybermen?
Particularly when they've got a fleet nearby.
Yes.
Which could have done. I see what you mean. What is the point of the Cybermen being on the ship? They need perhaps 10 or 20 to take over the freighter.
Yeah. And also, it must have taken them ages for them all to get out of that airlock and float out into
space. I was going to say, it's not entirely sure how they got off the freighter.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't spoil it for me. I think we've been blessed these last few weeks that the stories that I've chosen to watch with my friends have been fairly good pacey ones. I mean, I know they still look a little bit dated. I listened to the commentary of Earthshock as well as watching it. That's with Peter Davison, Janet Fielding, Sarah Sutton and Matthew Waterhouse. That was at the recommendation of Mark Cockrum on Twitter, who said it was solid gold and worth checking out. So I did. And it really is good value for money.
Was it one of those where it's, you might as well imagine that Matthew's in a completely different recording studio for all the attention the others pay him?
I'd heard that they were quite often mean to him, and I thought it seemed like quite a good atmosphere, actually.
We certainly thought so at Capitol, didn't we?
Yeah, yeah.
You remember when Sarah said to him about autographing your book across the middle,
and she told him off.
Think Janet has something to say about this?
Yes.
I must check up with you, Mark. If you listen to the commentary, what did Janet have to say about her hair and her makeup?
Oh, she said she looked like she'd had a frying pan on the back of her hair.
Oh, God, because I always like to check up.
Yeah, and she said her nail varnish was too dark.
Slightly more interestingly, from my point of view, I thought it was interesting that Adric's complaint against the Doctor was, you're supposed to be showing me how to do this shit, and yet none of you have got the time and you all want me to fuck off. which I thought was interestingly like Matthew Waterhouse's own experience on the show.
Very meta.
Mm. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, there was a couple of other interesting revelations from the DVD commentary was that Belle Reed had 28 cats. When Tegan grabs the cyber leader at the end and appears to overpower him slightly and put him off balance, which looks highly unlikely, Janet Fielding said, that's because Tegan is wearing a gold ring on her pinky finger. So, and that's on his chest unit. That's why the cyber leader staggers. Also, Peter Davison kept going on about a TV show that David Banks did in the 90s called Canary Wharf that was on live TV. Do you remember live TV at all, anyone?
No.
It was owned by the Mirror newspaper, and it was cheap and dreadful, and Canary Wharf was a soap opera they had in it, and the final episode of the show has the building Canary Wharf being taken away by aliens. David Banks on it.
I have a friend who actually wrote for Canary Wharf. He's part of the Hurt Hillbury team.
Really?
No.
Yeah, and as he recalls it, the process for getting to write for Canary Wharf was he wrote to them and said, can I write for Canary Wharf? And they said, yes.
God, if only submissions were that easy nowadays, I would be the editor of DWM.
Indeed, yeah.
Talking about meta content, the Daily Mirror opening a TV station that's cheap and dreadful.
Well, they've always wanted to compete more directly with Murdoch, I suppose.
Well, yes. Yeah, but there is a lovely scene at the end of Canary Wharf, which features David Banks sat in his office in Canary Wharf, looking at his glass of water, which suddenly starts vibrating. And then he looks up and says, they're here. And then there's a big light on his face. He says, they're here. And then he shouts something inaudible and Canary Wharf dematerialises.
Brilliant.
A thrilling end.
Genius. I'll tell Paul you enjoyed it.
Please do. I really did enjoy it. Else to say about this? Pretty much, I think most of what I've the rest of the stuff I've got to say is probably revolves around Adric, so but I think we should come to that later, shouldn't we?
If at all.
Oh, we will.
Adric, what happens to him in this?
Yes, my two hosts were surprised that Adric died. One of them did suggest that it was futile
for the best,
ego driven. they did say we can understand why people don't like him, but it's certainly not a problem that I've ever had. Well, I'll say what I was going to say now anyway. Adric was a very important character for me when I was growing up. I think I was 9 when he joined the show, and I'd just left Cardiff and moved to Wiltshire, so I'd left my old home behind and was trying to make it with new friends.
There was an obvious parallel.
I was very much a gangly, awkward chap with a stilted delivery, much like Adric and much like I still am today. And I really related to him, and he was doing what I wanted to do, which was to fly around with the Doctor in the TARDIS. And I remember when I saw the final episode of Earthshock, I cried. I was incredibly moved by his death, and it had a big, big influence on me, to the point that I started inserting heroic deaths into all my narratives that I developed when I was playing with my action figures and stuff. Indeed, up to the point that I had my favourite doll was a Planet of the Apes doll. Galen was the name of the character.
Played by Roddy McDowall.
Can't
remember. Yes, he was my favourite character. He was the chimp. It's the TV series, wasn't it?
Yes, I think so, yeah.
Two guys spending every single episode running across Ape World trying to get somewhere, being helped by a chimp called Galen,
mm-hmm.
who was, I think, played by Roddy McDowall. being chased by the gorilla chief called Urko, who was played by... Oh, I can't remember what's his name. Anyway, the guy who plays Sarek in the original Star Trek. Spock's dad.
Mm-hmm.
Carry on, Mark.
Well, so I developed this taste for heroic death. So I had my dog, Galen, and he was my favourite toy. And one day I got so carried away with this narrative that he was jumping from my bunk bed and he was grabbing hold of the lampshade, but then he got cut to ribbons by a laser defence system. And I got so deep into the narrative and wanting to maintain the integrity of the plot that had unfolded in my head, I chopped him up with a knife into pieces. I still have his foot somewhere in a tin. Yeah, I got that carried away to it. It was amazing. It was incredible.
What a heroic death.
And I blame the death of Adric for that. The next day when I woke up, I was terribly upset because I didn't have a Galen to play with anymore, but that sounds slightly wrong.
Planet of the Apes is an American science fiction television series in 1974. The series stars Roddy McDowall, Ron Harper, James Norton, Mark Lennard, and
Mark
Boone
Lamar?
Cullen.
Mark Lamar?
Mark Lennard. God, that takes me back. I remember that better than the films, that TV series. In fact, Mark, once we've finished certain scenes, that may be our next DVD.
Oh, yeah.
We've just started on, Mark and I, Faithless Listeners, if you're not picked this up yet, While Away the Late Hours from about 11 o'clock to midnight onwards some nights by watching DVDs together from about the 80 miles distance between us. We sync our DVDs via Facebook Messenger.
Is the Whoosium that big? So that's what happens when me and Ellen are in bed.
80 miles is roughly the distance between my bedroom in the west wing of the Hoosium and Mark's bedroom in the east wing.
It crosses four international time zones, one for each of us.
I can still hear him snoring. It reverberates all through the box.
And having recently gone through
Firefly
with him and the Serenity movie, which he was in raptures about.
Yes.
We've now got on to, what's it called?
Shadows.
An old 70s kids horror series called The Shadows, directly in the middle of which last night I had a power cut, so I had to cut it off.
I think you were just scared.
Bill Squires from The Shadow from
Armageddon
Factor. And
Gareth Thomas.
Gareth Thomas Blake is a fanatical Welsh football teacher. Very strange. How do you get onto this?
Just because I mentioned Planet of the Apes. You got off on quite the tangent, which isn't like you.
Playing with Galen, Planet of the Apes. Very sad that when you woke up the next morning you realised you'd destroyed your Galen toy.
Yeah, but that was just me. So the death of Adric had quite a big impact on me.
I used to cut the heads off my toy soldiers, cut the heads off my toy animals, and stick one on the other.
You were in Toy Story 3, weren't you?
Apparently, I found out much later. My parents were desperately worried about me. I think it was based on a series at the time in 2000 AD called Meltdown Man, where all the animals sort of walked on their hind legs.
Yeah, the box that Doc resides in is actually the box in which the final Moreau hybrid is delivered in the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen Part 2.
The Island of Doctor Who.
For anyone who hasn't read the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen Part 2, Dr. Moreau provides the hybrid monster that cleanses the Earth of Martians at the end of the War of the Worlds.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right.
Dr. Moreau's hybrid is part anthrax and part streptococcus. If anyone asks, the Martians died of the common cold.
Very good read.
I need to read that again, actually, that book. Brilliant.
Great stuff.
Or just dance along to the album.
Yes.
Have you managed to retain the thread of where you were, Alan? Mark?
Yeah, no, that was pretty much it. Just saying that I liked Adric a lot and his death had quite a profound effect on me.
Did Adric's death have a similarly profound effect on you, Alan?
Oh, I thought it was hilarious.
Well, the thing is, Alan wouldn't have watched it at the time as an 11-year-old boy, would he? So,
No.
On broadcast.
No, that's right.
No, I thought it was long past due. I was extremely happy about it. I particularly like the way when Peter Davison is trying to comfort Janet Fielding and Sarah Sutton over it, He just obviously doesn't give a shit. I thought that was a brilliant moment of acting from Peter Davison, but unfortunately... Spider-Man does whatever... That's to say, the interesting thing for me with Adric in this one was that he spent all his time complaining that the Doctor was supposed to be helping him out and just ignored him all the time. And I thought, well, this is surely just Matthew Waterhouse talking. It's not... He doesn't know the cameras are rolling, does he? Yeah, so that was interesting. But as far as I'm concerned, the standout thing about this episode, apart from the well-deserved death of Adric, is Beryl Reed's performance. She gets serious. An awful lot of stick for this, and she's the best thing in it by a long country mile. All the other actors are doing terribly worthy science fiction 1980s acting, where you stand still with your face immobile and just mumble grimly, which is a mode of expression that Matthew McConaughey is currently repopularizing as we speak. And Beryl Reed is doing the smart thing and just playing it like a soap opera. And everyone says she doesn't understand what she's doing. She doesn't have to. She's the captain of a boat and all she cares about is the money. End of character.
Yeah, I agree.
Tom always used to boast he never knew what he was supposed to be doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's why he wore cabbages on his shoulders.
Controversial.
Is it? Should I have said lettuce? But yeah, that was the main thing that stuck with me, that the most derided acting comes from Beryl Reed and Matthew Waterhouse. All right, Matthew Waterhouse is a bit stagey and weird, but it's still more interesting than anything any of the women in this, apart from Beryl Reed.
He's actually a lot better in this, Matthew Waterhouse, isn't
he? Oh, yeah. I think his performance in his final scenes as well are really good. Well, I think he's working at a level, you know, a fairly high level all the way through it, to be honest.
To be fair, he's actually given something to do, isn't he? He's given as annoying as it might be, him whinging in his bedroom, pay attention to me. He's given something to do. He's given to show off his mathematical excellence. He gets to be the cause of the plot point that builds up the tension at the end of the ship messing around, going back in time and that. And he gets to die. It's better than just wandering around the TARDIS, sort of moping with the others, isn't it?
Which he wasn't particularly happy about, was he? It was revealed to him that he was going to be killed off, and it took Peter Davison saying to him, look, this is going to be the one which everybody remembers, because, you know, it's such an uncommon event. Of course, now Stephen Moffat's come along, and now you have, if you don't have a companion die at least once in a season, then you want your money back. But at this point, it was completely... Well, it hadn't been done in a generation, had it? It hadn't been done since, since Sarah Kingdom in Dalek Master Plan.
Can you imagine if instead of JNT in this period, it had been Moffat? And so Matthew had discovered that he was being killed off at the end of Earthshock. He just thought, great, they're picking up my contract for the next 3 years.
He would become the boy who waited, or, you know, whatever it is. You know, it'd be...
The funniest, I couldn't keep my face straight. I don't think it was intended to be intentionally amusing. But, you know, when Adric is singing in the TARDIS at the start, I want to go back to Pterodon. And the Doctor's saying, no, it's very, very dangerous. Very, very dangerous. You'd have to go back to E-Space. And Nyssa is saying... we'd have to go through the CBE. We'd never find it. It's just impossible, Adric. It would just be far too dangerous. Then Tegan's line is...
Is it really that dangerous?
She wants to get a shot of him, doesn't she?
She's had enough, yeah, at this point. I just... Do you know what? I watched this story on Sunday. And you know what? Even though it's highly regarded as Peter Davison's second best story as the Doctor, and
after Time Flight,
there's so much more. You know, that I was thinking actually after
Time Crash,
after The King's Demons. But anyway, there you go. That's the... But this story's never really worked for me, and the reason being is because it is based all upon surprises. Oh, can you pass me a line as well, please? Yeah, I spent my whole life as a fan being told what happens in Earthshock and what to look out for, and this is a good one because da 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 happens or that happens. This is very much a story that I think works the first time you watch it, if you haven't been spoiled. And then after that, you can appreciate it for being quite a strong plot.
Mm.
But for me, you know, I've read in one of the David J. Howell books as a kid that Adric was killed at the end of Earthshock. And I've read in another book that the Cybermen, I think it was another David J. Howell book actually, said that the Cybermen made a surprise return. And then any shock and surprise was duly ruined on the front cover of the initial BBC video and also DVD releases.
Yeah, it's a bit like the Planet of the Apes DVD covers, which have Statue of Liberty on them.
Absolutely, yeah. So where's the shock? Now, when you watch, I mean, I really enjoy, this is obviously not talking about the story for the time being, but I really enjoy the documentary on the DVD of this. What is it called? Putting the Shock into Earthshock. You know, when they talk about the measures that they went to, you know, they turned down the first Radio Times front cover in, 8 or 9 years, I think, to keep this under wraps. The viewing gallery was closed during the studio recording for this. You know, all of these measures that they went to ensure that there were going to be no spoilers escaping before transmission. And what you've got there, Mark, and your generation of fans, is that sort of that nostalgic feel of, oh, God, this was brilliant because of, when the Cybermen turned up, we all genuinely thought, oh, my God, we can't believe they're back.
Hmm.
But subsequent generations, they just do not get that shock and surprise. You know that they are back. You know that Adric's doomed from the offset. And that's always sort of dampened my enjoyment of the story, really. Because you're just waiting for things that you know are going to happen.
Well, this is why when I watched this story with my two friends, and also previously when I watched it with Polly, they didn't know that was Adric's last story. And with Polly, I'd also watched several other Adric stories beforehand to get her to get her attached to the character before I cruelly...
that was probably the worst way of getting her attached to the character.
Showed her episode 4, but yeah, and so she didn't know about the Cybermen or Adric's death either, and yes, everyone who didn't have those surprises enjoyed them.
Mm. You know how this season was it was recorded all out of sequence, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So I think they did Force Doomsday first, then I think it was The Visitation, wasn't it? Then it was Castrovalva. I get the sense that Peter Davison is still trying to find his doctor in this. There's little moments where he's sort of feeling the lapels on his jacket. I think it's in episode 3, I think. A bit like William Hartnell. He's just still trying to find his feet, I think, at this point. And I don't like the dynamic. Doc said this many a time, that one of the reasons why he turned off back in the day was because all of a sudden they just seem to be arguing on the TARDIS. You know, there doesn't seem to be the Doctor and his best friend gallivanting around time and space. It's now, a very young Doctor with three teenagers all bickering and arguing. And it was interesting that in that first episode, you know, the Doctor cannot take criticism at all. Acts like a rather sort of...
petulant child.
Yes, he does. Yes, essentially, yeah.
He gets called out on that as well, doesn't he, by Adric?
He does, yes. Yeah. And then he acts, and then he acts upon it. You know, he just sort of continues. And it's very sort of out of character for the Doctor, I feel, that.
I would say that conflict, though, doesn't carry on. It is resolved in the next episode, which I think is in quite a charming scene between Peter Davison and Matthew Waterhouse.
When they're defusing the bomb, isn't it?
Well, they defuse the bomb, and also when they're back in the TARDIS and... Yeah.
They defuse the tension.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Mm. That first episode is brilliant, I think. It really builds up that tension well, that sort of intrigue. I can imagine being a child in the 80s watching this and thinking, blimey, what's happening? Why are these people being turned into large piles of snot? What the hell is doing this? You know, and obviously that reveal right at the very end of the episode. Watching it again, it's good, don't get me wrong, but it just didn't click this time, and I don't know what it was, really. I think with the other stories that we've reviewed recently, there's been enough there for me to go back and watch and for me to remember little bits that had happened that I'd completely forgotten. So, you know, like when we did Seeds of Doom, I completely forgot that the Doctor snapped Scorby's neck at one point, you know, and there are little things that sort of make me jump up and go, oh, hang on a minute. And I can sort of bring that up. But with this, I don't know. It feels very familiar. But I think, I don't know. It's different. It just didn't click this time. I've loved it when I watched it in the past. But this time, I don't know. I can't quite put my finger on it, actually.
I'm not going to repeat what I said last time about the JNT era and things being a long, slow decline for me ever since Key to Time. Oh, look, I just repeated myself. But I enjoyed this quite a lot watching it at the weekend, but it's one I could have taken or left. Great bits, obviously, and the notable bits in Doctor Who history, like the death of Adric, were must-see stuff. But for the rest of it, to be honest, if you think about it, most of the first episode or so is this team of soldiers wandering through caves, looking for something and shooting people. A lot of that stuff on the freighter is people wandering around the freighter shooting people. A lot of it is the Doctor and his pals going around shooting Cybermen. And as good as that is, it's not... The Doctor doesn't win, does he?
No.
What does he do? Like I think we said a few times, he doesn't do anything. This whole idea... What was that song of Craig? What's his name?
Craig David?
No, who's the American talk show host, the Scottish one?
Oh, Craig Ferguson.
Craig Ferguson. Where he does, have you seen that cold open he does?
No.
The song where he comes on, they got banned because they didn't have the rights to the Doctor Who theme tune. Have you not seen this?
No.
Mm-hmm.
He comes on at the beginning of his show and starts singing a song and dancing about Doctor Who. And the chorus of it is, the reason why this show is so beloved by geeks and nerds, it's all about the triumph of intellect and romance over brute force and ignorance.
Mm.
Which I think we like to think about Doctor Who, don't we? And yet, what does he do to hear the Doctor that's intelligent? Adric's the only one that attempts anything intelligent, which is diffusing the logic device. Possibly the Doctor does intelligent bit ways diffusing the bomb in episode 2, but then he's, in a way, that's more... It's more like someone in an inspection pit in a garage, isn't it, fixing your motor? It's a bit like, you're the games fan here, Mark. Do you know what I just said? I just nearly said Adric then. Sorry, Mark.
He'd take it as a compliment. Don't apologise.
It's a shoot-em-up, essentially, isn't it?
Yeah.
And not too bad for that, but, you know...
Well, it is different and it is slightly out of character, but I suppose it is the Doctor being pushed to his limits because this Doctor does not have the capability of, you know, his previous incarnation to talk his way out of trouble or to belittle the enemy into, you know, you're just a pathetic bunch of tin soldiers scuttling around the galaxy in an ancient spaceship. He hasn't got that capability anymore. All he can do is strike up, you know, saying emotions have their uses. When was the last time you smelt a flower? Or you ate a well-prepared meal. You know, that's as good as it gets for him in this, I feel. And it's that look of anguish in that moment when Adric is sort of made to stay behind, but he says, look, just leave, go without me. And that look of anguish, it's a Doctor who's completely powerless. And it's interesting in sort of the scope of the series that, you know, this is the vulnerable Doctor. Doesn't make him wimpy at all. Because he can take on a Cyberman, yes, shoot him from point-blank range, which gives him some power back. And also, you know, he sort of holds the Cyberman back, doesn't he, while he's sort of using the badge to suffocate his chest unit as well. So this is a Doctor who, he's completely out of his depth, so has to resort to the extreme to win, essentially.
Yeah, I suppose so. But then, so why write him as someone who's out of his depth, knowing that the consequences of that will be he had to go around killing people?
But I think that was a deliberate choice by the production team, wasn't it? I think from the moment Peter Davison was cast, they wanted to make the Doctor more vulnerable. They yes. felt that Tom Baker's Doctor had become invincible and there was no...
But surely that's the point.
...jeopardy.
The way to make him vulnerable is not to have Tom just snapping his fingers, but actually show some struggle and anguish or whatever from the Fifth Doctor. When he is coming up with an intellectual or a non-violent solution to things, yes, I know that as Tom himself has said on the Tom Baker years, violence is all about the failure of the imagination. Yes, that's it. Yeah. Violence is the failure of the imagination. It's not the failure of strength or ability. So I don't see the logical link between let's make the Doctor more vulnerable and let's have him going around, rushing around with ray guns, killing things. I just don't, you know, I don't think there's a logical link between those two. Do the normal Doctor Who shtick. Here's the monsters. We'll struggle against them. We'll run around being scared. And then we'll come up with a cleverish solution. But do it with Peter Davison playing the Doctor as a vulnerable character. Don't do it with him playing the Doctor as someone who doesn't know the he's doing half the time. That's not vulnerable. That's incompetent.
Well, the Tom Baker's Doctor didn't know what the he was doing half the time. The point was it didn't really matter.
In what way did he not know what he was doing?
Well, he was making it up as he went along, wasn't he? He's not the Sylvester McCoy master manipulator of the new adventures. Tom Baker just gets stuck in. Give it here, I'll have a go.
He knew what he was doing. May not have had an intricately devised plan ahead of him, but he had the confidence, effectively, to wing it.
That's the thing, though, isn't it? There's a blithe arrogance to Tom Baker's character that Peter Davison's Doctor doesn't have.
But it doesn't mean that Peter has to then just resort to the lowest common denominator.
And for some reason, it always seems to have been all right for the Doctor to kill Cybermen. They don't count for some reason. I don't know why.
Yeah, that's true.
He doesn't usually take quite such a hands-on approach, though, does he?
No.
No.
I don't want to sound like I was completely down on the story. I mean, it's a good story. I just feel that, you know, 35 years on, after relentless spoils, you know, through books throughout the time, it just completely ruined it for me, but there you go.
I think it's one of those things, it's a good story, but it's not worth its reputation.
Well, it's got that. Well, hang on, I mean, let's have a look at it. I've got the
once you've had the Cyberman reveal, which admittedly is brilliantly executed, it's not exactly then a page turner, is it?
Let's have a quick look, hang on a second, at the where the DWM poll had it, because I know it was in the top 20. 17th in 2014.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's higher than I'd put it. I think production-wise, it's pretty good, actually. I think the effects, on the whole, are really nice. I mean, that...
Well, maybe apart from the rays coming out of the rifle, which looks like Blackpool Rock.
Oh, yeah, yes. They're pretty poor. In fact, the scene when the Cybermen are overrunning the base and there's two men on the stairs, largely hidden by a gantry thanks to some brilliant directing, and they have those feeble guns that fire rays of candy beams at the Cybermen. If you look, the chap on the left isn't even bothering. Nobody's bothered to edit a laser beam in for him, so he's just stood there pointing his gun at the Cybermen and going, well, this is futile, isn't it?
Hey, one of those women is Val McCrimmon, the assistant floor manager.
Yeah.
Who's shooting one of those.
She the one who's not trusted with a loaded gun, in case she kills all the actors.
Is it true that in this, at one stage, there's a floor manager just casually sitting on a stool in shock?
Yeah, it's not. They're not sitting on a stool, they're standing in the background. You can just about see them. You can just see the script they're holding, actually. And you can see a page being turned as well. She was, according to Pete Davison on the commentary, she was a trainee and she was shadowing another member of staff. And they didn't notice until the show went out and Peter Davison was sat at home watching it. And he immediately saw this woman in the background of the shot and phoned up John Nathan Turner and told him. And he didn't believe him. And he went away and had another look. And yeah, there she was. It was obviously, it had been broadcast. It was too late to do anything about it.
Well, we covered Remembrance last time. I was expanding upon my best view that Doctor Who is a slow downward trend from Key to Time until Rose. And I've been wondering watching this whether if part of that was the quality of the casting. But during what I insist on calling the Golden Years, you could be pretty sure that most of the characters would be played by experienced actors. And actors who, while still being from that slightly stagey school of acting, had the confidence and brio to carry it off. So, for example, you've got Jellicoe in Robot. He's a pretty inconsequential character. He just spends most of his time on stepladders fiddling around in the robot with a screwdriver, doesn't he? And all the menace is written in that story for Miss Winter, and all the humour is written for Kettlewell. But there's not one moment when I don't believe in Jellicoe, or that actor doesn't appear to believe in his character. Ronson and Garman, sort of second-level characters in Genesis, are the same. There's not one for me of the non-regular cast in Earthshock who manages to convey that confidence in the role. By far the most interesting thing about the soldiers in the caves are the torches on the sides of the helmets. By far the most engaging thing about Lieutenant Scott is his moustache. Berger, which I was just called, the first mate. Beryl Reed's first mate. Might as well not be there. What about the scenes of Nyssa standing in the TARDIS, the walkie-talkie, saying that's electromagnetic fields going again, you know? And for the dull woman with her who lends her her overalls. Admittedly, you need a good script for them to work with. But I think really for me it's just a series of young, bland actors. You know, I keep coming in every week and saying, oh, I was watching this thing from the Bill from the early 80s or this series from the 70s. And it's got all these people in who've, oh, he was in Doctor Who. This is some kind of repertory company. You get the idea that either they're no longer being used or they're just going for, oh, we must have a younger, more active feel to the show. So let's go for essentially less experienced actors. They give them nothing to do. I mean, what else could make you perk up? When you're watching Visitation, what else could make you perk up at the casting of the dad from On the Buses? In Michael Robbins. Who's really good in it. Not amazing, but he, you know, what I said about a hill only stands out because of the flatness of the surrounding landscape. Bland doctor, bland companions, bland supporting actors. I'm not sure about Beryl Reed, really. She didn't do anything for me. And I found her constant moaning at Ringway. Oh, something, mister. Far more irritating than her acting style. To me, she's not given a personality by the writer. She's given an attitude. But for many years, I had her confused with Hilda Baker. Hilda Baker was, shall we say, a soap star in the 70s. The era when soaps mainly consisted of people laughing at their black neighbours.
You mean sitcom?
Yeah, sorry, sitcom.
Did Hilda Baker do that Grease song with Arthur Mallard?
I think she possibly did, yes.
I got chills, they're multiplying, and I'm losing control. Course of power you're supplying, it's electrifying.
You better shape up, cause I need a man.
Oh, God, that's terrible, that. I've heard that. Jesus Christ.
Yes, I'm so sorry for mentioning it.
She was the star of a sitcom in the 70s called Not On Your Nelly, where she was the landlady of a pub in the East End of London. She just has a vague facial remembrance to Beryl Reed. That's what made me confuse the two. And the main thing I remember is that there was one character who was... There was a gay couple in it, which admittedly I suppose was quite revolutionary for that early in the 70s on TV, who would turn up in the pub, and this gay character would be dressed like, say, the Bee Gees on an over-elaborate day. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of thigh-high, white boots and a swirling caftan.
Not entirely progressive then.
And she would say, her line would be, "What are you today, Gilbert?" And he'd do a twirl. She'd say, "Oh, you're one of those, are you?
Gilbert! Gilbert! Oh, what are you today, Gilbert? Oh, you're one of those, eh?"
And then the whole audience would fall about laughing. It's the era of the catchphrase. Your audience would fall about laughing. But for me, at least Hilda Baker would have been interesting. Comparing with Beryl Reed. "What canonically inconsistent emotion are you displaying today, cyber leader? Oh, you're one of those, are you?" Maybe what we're experiencing here is the transition on British TV between that era when TV acting was quite stagey to where it's clear they're going to end up moving to a more naturalistic style of acting. And maybe in between the two, the actors have just lost their confidence and brio. Sorry, Alan, was I interrupting?
I was going to say 70s sitcoms, when you watch them, really help you to understand precisely how my parents' generation have gone about making such a useless mess of the country. If this was their idea of what was funny, they must just be idiots to a man.
Talking about the quality of actors, we should also take a look at the quality of extras. Extras who can be a little too enthusiastic.
At the start of the Pandoric opens, it's almost in the first minute, you've got Vincent van Gogh going mad in his little house while his housekeeper is saying, oh, it's even worse than the usual rubbish he paints. And then the scene switches to Churchill's cabinet war rooms, the underground bunker.
And as you know, it's a series of underground rooms connected by narrow corridors. So narrow, it'd be quite a squeeze for two people to pass each other in a corridor.
And there's a Tommy with a rifle over his shoulder,
standing guard in the corridor, and he's clearly a sentry. He's just an extra, he's got no lines or anything. And he must have been thinking, oh, this is my big chance to get noticed. So, how do you act a sentry? Oh, a sentry regularly patrols, marching up and down along his route of his patrol, doesn't he? So the sentry starts pacing up and down across the width of the corridor. So it's 1.5 paces forward, smart turnaround, 1.5 paces back, over and over. And what reminded me of this? Are you thinking, why didn't someone say, look, son, can you just stand still? Don't try to use your imagination. What reminded me of this?
Can I guess what reminded you of this?
Yes. Go on.
Would it be two Cybermen guarding the corridor, sat there, yes, having a lovely chat about what they're going to do on their holidays?
You've got two cyber sentries standing guard at the end of the corridor of the freighter, turning to each other and chatting to pass the time.
With hand gestures.
I know, hand gestures! Cybermen! Lord knows what they chose to chat about. Do you remember that scene in Star Wars where Alec Guinness is standing on the lip of that deep shaft having just turned off the tractor beam?
Oh, yeah.
But he can't escape because there's a couple of stormtroopers guarding the bridge over the shaft. And eventually he does something with the Force and they say, oh, what's that? They turn around and he scoots off. But while they're just standing there, idly on the sentry coat, one of them says to the other something like,
do you know what's going on? Maybe it's another drill. That new BT-16? Yeah, some other guy was telling me about it. They say it's quite thick. What was that?
Now, I was wondering what might be the equivalent of that in cyber sentry gossip. Have you seen that new Hotpoint BT-16 fridge freezer? Yeah, some of the other drones were telling me about it. They tell me it's pretty cool. It just seems utterly bizarre. So much must have said to them. I suppose when you've got Ian Levine supposed to be there on set. No, Cybermen don't do this. Unless they were just refusing to play ball. What else is there? I quite like Matthew Waterhouse in this.
Mm.
He's not. So you think, oh, what a standout performance across the last 20-odd years. But for Adric, it's a standout performance. There's quite an interesting interaction between the two of them. They're asking each other questions. They're wandering through the freighter. And the doctor says, Adric does something. The doctor says, what's the matter?
What's the matter?
Got the feeling we were spotted rather a long time ago.
We're being followed?
Now, normally that should be the other way around, shouldn't it?
Mm.
Adric says, oh, what's the matter, doctor?
Yes.
I think we're being spotted. And Adric said, oh dear, are we being followed? Now, that possibly chimes in what you were saying about the less confident doctor.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, there's no need at all for that to be the doctor, is it? It's an utterly inconsequential line. You might as well give it to the companion to give them something to say. By the way, Mark, 9-year-old Mark, when you saw Adric's bedroom, did you think, oh, wish I had a bedroom like that?
But yeah, it's got a space chart in it and everything.
Did it have the Magna Carta?
When I saw the doctor talking to Adric in his bedroom, he's wandering around picking up the various props from the series.
Hmm.
I was reminded of the front page of Hayden's book. Actually, will you hang up your burgundy dressing gown, please?
That's where we got the inspiration from. Well, it's the same bedroom, isn't it, that Romana has in Full Circle?
It's, oh, right, is it?
Yeah, it is. So she's...
I thought they jettisoned that, though, in Legopolis.
Oh, it's the same set.
Oh.
And there are references to K-9 and Romana, isn't there? And there's quite a lot of references to E-Space and stuff.
That was...
Is this the most continuity-heavy episode that we've had so far? Because when I was watching it with my friends, I became very conscious of a lot of references to past adventures. Was this where it sort of really started tipping over, this adventure?
Yeah, because you also have that, you have that moment where you sort of have flashbacks to previous adventures, don't you?
Hmm.
You see, I came up with a lot of stuff I was going to say about, oh, it's terribly canonical that the Cybermen are suddenly, instead of being emotionless, now primarily vindictive and gloating. And then I thought, well, yeah, maybe they have got a point that there's only so much of that you can write without it being totally boring conversation. But the problem with that is, if you make the Cybermen full of emotion, and the Doctor's supposedly big line, when did you last have pleasure of smelling a flower, watching a sunset, eating a well-prepared meal? That ought to be with Cybermen, saying, it's not, when did you last smell a flower, watch a sunset, eat a well-prepared meal, which might be, you know, you sacrificed that by making yourselves all metal. It's, when did you last have the pleasure of doing these things? Well, they're not emotionless now. I'm not particularly sure that works. What amazed me most of all is I actually felt sorry for Adric at the end. I used to find him mildly annoying. He didn't annoy me that much. But if you think about it, his end is actually genuinely tragic, yeah, in the sense of what tragic actually means. He's brought down by his fatal flaw.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll jump out of the airlock. I know what I can do. I can save the situation. I'm really clever.
And well, actually, for it to be genuinely tragic in the Greek sense, he would have had to realise he'd been brought down by his fatal flaw before he died.
Yes, I suppose so. Well, maybe he did, just as he was just a second before he hit the Yucatan Peninsula.
It's the argument that's always advanced against Othello being a genuinely tragic play, isn't it? That Othello never actually realises that he was a jealous man.
Do you imagine if they'd given the plot of Othello to the BBC's early 70s sitcom writers?
Othello, my neighbour.
The one awkward point is when he says Adric's final line, "I'll now never know if I was right," he's clutching that piece of string that his brother gave him, isn't he?
Yeah.
Mm.
And I'm afraid it does make you think back to Full Circle, at the end of Full Circle, and think, if only Varsh had been the one that went and travelled with the Doctor instead of Adric.
No.
Yeah, I liked they kept throwing in little bits of his Full Circle theme tune as well, didn't they?
Oh, did they? I didn't
know. Yes,
which I thought was a lovely little touch.
Yeah.
Hayden, have you just put a DVD on there? I'm so glad.
I can also do... No, I won't do any more. Anyway, moving on.
That's me finished.
Just one other thing before we wrap up then. What about the, at that point, new design of the Cybermen? Because we haven't spoken about that at all. Because, I mean, this is the design I sort of grew up with. You know, I had the Daypole figure of this form of Cybermen and really, really liked it. You know, they sort of had that real sort of link between human and machine, but human in the fact that you could clearly tell there were human bodies underneath.
Yeah, and those glass jaws that they have, so to speak, you know.
And those new voices too. Yeah.
Although they've painted the mouth silver underneath, which seems to defeat the object somewhat to me.
Why did they bother with the gold then? If they know that Cybermen have got glass jewels, just get the punch. Gold does annoy me, actually. I come from the generation of... My Doctor was the tail end of John and most of Tom. And so, of course, I only had one Cyberman experience.
Gold annoys me because my Doctor was Martin Kemp.
My notion of the Cyberman is the wetsuit look from Revenge. But in Revenge, you can believe it. Look, gold, non-corrosive metal, plates their breathing apparatus and suffocates them. If You inject them with gold via the cybermats, or you chuck a handful of gold dust in their chest units. That makes sense.
Mm.
But then, for the rest of the series, it's, oh, that means now that just firing a gold coin at a Cyberman with a catapult will kill one of them. Scratching a bit of Adric's gold badge into his chest unit will kill him. Which makes the Cybermen just comically daft, doesn't it?
It doesn't kill him, it weakens him, doesn't it? Because they have to finish him off then with the cyber gun, don't they?
Possibly.
It just weakens him to a point that he's sort of then on that level. You know, it's... I didn't see that as finishing him off. I saw the gunning down, you know, killing off the cyber controller. But it's... or cyber leader even, sorry. But, yeah, good look. I think in recent years, I think everyone's favourite look is the original, isn't it, though, for the Cybermen?
Yes.
Or the creepiest, yeah.
Oh, it's Tombs for me.
Or that one, yeah, or that one.
I think it's most effective.
Yeah.
The voice has to be 10th Planet for me.
Mm. The Mondasians are definitely the creepiest, I think. I do quite like this era of Cybermen. I like the way the Cyber Commander has clearly just had a brevet field promotion where they've just wrapped some duct tape around his handles and gone, there you go, lad.
Oh, there's a Cyberman with a little pot of Airfix black paint.
Sounds still Cyber Leader.
Yeah, you can tell why he's the Cyber Leader, though, isn't he? When you hear the other Cybermen talk, they just don't have any oomph at all, do they?
But no.
When the Cyber Leader speaks, it's...
You bloody well listen, don't you?
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, really, all the others are just saying is bringing reports, isn't it?
Yeah.
We have captured the Phaeton Leader. He can't really make much emotionally out of it. Bits and pieces. I love the visuals of the Cyberman trapped in the door.
Oh, yeah.
That must have cost a bomb, that, to realise that. But I think it was really good.
Mm.
It's such a simple idea. Marks out of 10, I'm going to give it a 6. Hayden?
I'm going to be a bit more generous with that. I still think it's a good story, and it's probably one of the best of the 80s, but I don't know, just on this occasion, it just didn't grab... Like I said, I don't know what it is. Maybe I just wasn't in the mood, I don't know, but I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10, because it's a good story, it's well directed. Okay. I just feel maybe time hasn't been... very forgiving to it, perhaps. I don't know. But yeah, 8 out of 10, I'd say.
Alansky?
I am going to give it 6 out of 10, rising to 8 for episodes 1 and 4.
Mm.
Because 1 has the spectacular reveal of the Cybermen, and 4 has Adric humorously dying.
Such a bully. Oh.
Marco?
I have to say, I do quite often feel sometimes that the criticism of Adric and Matthew Waterhouse in fandom sometimes does feel a little bit like bullying.
Oh, I've always thought that.
You realise he's an adult now, though?
Sorry?
He's not still a kid, he's an adult now.
Well, no, indeed.
No, I don't agree with that at all. It's still bullying.
Mm.
If you get frozen out at work or something, you don't feel, oh, I'm an adult now, I can cope with this. It still hurts.
Mm.
Particularly when it's something... I mean, let's imagine that one of you... not you, Alan. Mark. Suddenly got the chance to play an extra in Doctor Who, and you f***ed up or something, and for the rest of time, you couldn't go on a Doctor Who forum without thinking that someone would be ridiculing you. Not the character, but you, the actor, the person. You might feel, oh, I'm a Doctor Who fan, but I can never go on. I've got to avoid online Doctor Who in future. I don't know, it just seems unpleasant, really.
Oh, well, that's the difference, you see. I can't stand Adric at all. He's f***ing dreadful. But we saw Matthew Waterhouse at the Capitol last year, and he was extremely good on the panel and very pleasant to talk to. Direct, absolutely no malice towards Matthew Waterhouse at all. He's lovely. I just can't stand Adric. And partly, it's the fact of a teenage character at all. It could have been anybody in that role, and I would have hated it, because I always hated the way middle-aged studio executives think children are interested in watching children on screen. They're not, because they don't have the freedom to do anything. Adults are interested on screen because they can have sex and all sorts.
Yeah, but I disagree with you, because like, between the age of 9 to 11, when Adric was on screen, I thought he was brilliant. And it was what I wanted to do. And yeah, I got a totally different experience. But that's because of the age that I grew up watching the programme.
But it's also to do with your other personal circumstances as well, that the character resonated more with you because of his fish out of the water aspect.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll give it 7.5.
Right. Well.
Have you knocked a mark off for Adric Dyne?
I am quite surprised how low we've actually scored this. I'd like to see, with our other 80s stories that we've reviewed recently, what's come out on top, actually, out of Varos, Remembrance, and Earthshock.
Well, certainly Remembrance from my rating.
I have to say, actually, yeah, I wouldn't have knocked off a mark for Adric Dyne because narratively and emotionally, it worked for me. And also, looking back on the series, the fact that he stayed dead.
Yes, it's a blessing.
You know, no matter what you think about the character, whether you feel like Alan did, you know, and dislike him, or whether you feel like I did and like him a hell of a lot.
At least he's still dead. So it's your turn again, Doc.
So it's my turn.
Are we carrying on doing this?
Do you want to do another one?
I think, well, who haven't we chosen from yet? We haven't chosen a Pertwee. We haven't chosen a Troughton.
No, well, we did Pertwee and Troughton earlier on, didn't we?
Oh, that's yes, we did. Yeah, so really.
I mean, we haven't done much new. I don't know if it's new series or the TV movie.
I'm getting a little tired of being the miserable fool.
I recommend suicide.
Doing lots of 80s crap. I was going to suggest Robots of Death. Can we do Robots of Death?
Yeah, sounds good.
That's a four-parter, isn't it? Yeah, that'd be fine to do.
So, until next time.
Don't throw bodies into the river.
Uncle Terence, we have enemy ships in Sector 27.
It's a trap.
Bye-bye, everyone. Happy night.
See ya.
Sarah.
Bye.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at Diddly Dum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. It is liquid podcasting. Fit it in your ear.